guide program, and then we ask for certain documents to come to the infrastructure, the nutrition, and then I think I spoke to post positioning, and I'd like to thank the department that we do have it here with us. It just shows that you are on the ball, because someone else could say it's in Pretoria, but you have it on your computer. Seeing that we're going to look at infrastructure, nutrition, I think it will be important that we start then with program four. Then we know if we did, because look at the bulk of the money in program four goes to infrastructure. In program five, the bulk of the money goes to nutrition. So perhaps you can handle those two. And then after that, then we go to program one. Is it agreed upon? Yes, Honourable Jay.
Just in a point of order, Madam Chair, we should take a register this morning as well in terms of apology, surely.
And with these few words, I would like to welcome each and everyone in the meeting. Thank you. Apologies.
Thanks, Chair. Apologies have been received from Honourable Gina, Honourable Bushwana, Honourable Vukuza Linda, Honourable Dudley, and Honourable Jacobo.
Thanks a lot for that, Llewellyn. Is there a move for the apologies? For example, the people gave an apology, like Mr. Dean and Shuana, they are. And then, if we just vote to the call for them, Dudley, she has another meeting. The Corbo?
Just a point of order, ma'am, if I may. Apologies don't have to be moved or seconded. They simply have to be registered, and we clearly would accept that.
Fine, thanks a lot for that. Let's start with the meeting proper now. Let's start with program four, and then we'll look at infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. We will, as directed yesterday, present in the order that the Chair has just indicated now, starting with infrastructure. We propose then we follow with school nutrition, which is the second big spender, and post-provisioning. Let me then, without wasting time, just make one statement, and that is that honourable members, when considering these presentations, should bear in mind uppermost that what we're trying to do here is to talk about provincial competence in terms of delivery of these areas. We're also talking of trying to fix areas of weakness with regard to the delivery in provinces. And therefore, these grants have been conditional grants given to the DBE so that it can exercise overall coordination of these grants. And it's a mechanism government is using to try and ensure that even though the competence resides in the province, it allows national to direct much more explicitly how the process unfolds. Having said that, even though we've implemented conditional grants over the years, it's changed in the way we've defined the modality. You will see in infrastructure, the role of national has become stronger over the years. And now it's no more, we'll monitor you and we'll report. Now we're saying if we have a problem, we are going to act much more decisively. You'll see it in all of these presentations. So with that, I'll hand over to Mr. Pagliacci, who'll do the presentation on infrastructure. With your permission, ma'am.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Presentation is dealing with school infrastructure, referred to as Accelerated School Infrastructure Delivery Initiative. The Minister and the MECs had agreed on the focus for CD to cover the period 2010 to 2014. And it's basically a four-strand strategy. And I think just to indicate to the committee, in the past, you have indicated that you had concerns about the grant that dealt with the water, sanitation, electricity that came to an end. In the grants that we've been given basically bring that back into focus, but under the stewardship of the Department of Basic Education. The four strands look at basic services to bring schools to basic safety functionality, referring to water, sanitation, and electricity. The second is to replace all entire 395 mud schools in the Eastern Cape to optimum functionality. In other words, we will replace these schools in the Eastern Cape, the 395, and to replace all entire inappropriate structures, and with the fourth strand looking at upgrading schools to optimum functionality with the focus on providing core spaces, which we refer to as specialist rooms, in particular libraries, laboratories, and administration blocks. With respect to what has occurred over the last few months, provinces have been requested to reprioritize their infrastructure budgets to address the specialist rooms in libraries and laboratories, and also to address 74 entire inappropriate structures. We're referring to are the metal, timber, and prefabricated. They are not part of the mud, and this would be dealt with by provincial budgets. The conditional grants would look at addressing the mud schools, the 395, and the basic services. Now, the figures, the budget over the three-year period over the MTF is 8.2. Our focus is on ensuring that the 700 million makes an impact, and what we're focusing on over the MTF is to eradicate and replace the 395 mud schools. In terms of basic services, this will cover 3,007 water and sanitation facilities for schools, 536 in particular with sanitation, 1,434 schools with electricity. That's over the MTF. Now, what's different from in the past? The infrastructure backlog grant in particular is a Schedule 7 grant that is being administered by the DBE, and this will be centrally managed by DBE. So some of the peculiarities we've experienced where money was given to provinces and it was either used for other purposes or never got to the department would have been eliminated through this grant. The decision of the Council of Education Ministers was to indicate that 60% of this money, of the 700 million, would be allocated for mud schools in the Eastern Cape, and 40% in the first year would be for basic services. What this means is that provinces will need to provide business plans for the basic services, which are assessed by DBE and approved, and then as the project is implemented, there will be progress reports on a monthly basis. Of the 280 million, the Eastern Cape also gets the lion's share of it once again on basic services based on their backlogs. So you'll see in the table that's coming up, there's another 100 million, so 520 million of the 700 in the first year is to the Eastern Cape. The PEDs would also have to budget for other issues. We're looking at a total package that is not just about building a school and then leaving. There needs to be desks and chairs, library books, chemicals in the laboratories. The kitchens need to have the nutritional goods to be operational. So it's a total pack, including the teachers itself, if that school has to be provided with additional teachers because you've built additional classes. This is not to be funded, cannot be funded from the infrastructure budget, but in the planning of it, it needs to come out of the education budget. So this is basically the allocation, and as I indicated, the bulk of it goes to the Eastern Cape of the 520 million, which makes up the total of 700 million. In terms of the procurement strategy, we work closely with the Construction Industry Development Board, the CIDB, and we've categorized this into three categories to put it into packages. The first dealing with the buildings and non-waterborne toilets, the second solely looking at water, and the third with electricity. This program will be overseen by the Program Support Unit, also referred to as the CD unit, which we are setting up in the DBE. While it's being set up, the work is continuing. All this work has been being conducted by the unit that exists in the DBE at present, working with other departments like Treasury, Water Affairs, and Department of Energy. The progress to date, the target is to cover 100 MUD schools in 2011-12, which we have promised the President. The first batch of 50 will roll off onto the construction line by May, and this is in the Eastern Cape, and the implementing agent would be the Independent Development Trust. With regard to the CD projects, water and sanitation, we would participate in the transversal contract with the Department of Human Settlements, working together with the Department of Water and Human Settlements in terms of sanitation. With the electricity, we are in the process of finalizing the memorandum of agreement with ESCOM, which will be responsible for the electrification of schools, and this will be managed by DBE with the assistance of the Department of Energy. The planning for 2012-13 and the 13-14 year will be finalized in June, July, and we're looking at the verification of those backlogs, and we are going to get the assistance of a service provider to assist us with the verification. However, this service provider is not from the budgets of the Department of Basic Education. This is through the assistance of the National Treasury. Moving on to the infrastructure grant, the education infrastructure grant, and the draft grant framework. The Division of Revenue Bill will be finalized and enacted in April. What is going to occur is the provincial departments will submit their infrastructure plans. There's the term of the user asset management plans, the UAMs, but in simple terms, the infrastructure plan, which will have the prioritized project list that are signed off for the 2011, which has to be submitted to the provincial treasuries as well as the DBE by the 8th of April. Without this, there cannot be any transfers to the provincial departments. If provincial departments do not provide that, the DBE has an alternative list that it has planned on and which was submitted for provinces to take into account. So by the 8th, they need to sign off on and provide that list. Just going back to the basic services that would be covered by the 700 million, these are the targets of 354 for sanitation, water is 462, and 231 for electricity. You will note that of that 280 million, 100 million is in the Eastern Cape, and the bulk of the numbers are made up there. In Gauteng, basically, they've eradicated their water. If there's any other school that comes up, they will deal with it through their own budget. And you can see in KZN, the electricity is being dealt with outside the SCD funding. With the education infrastructure grant, which previously, we just need to give some background. National Treasury provided this as a supplement to the equitable share that provinces had, in that funding was said to be inadequate. This went through the provincial treasury to provincial education departments. The concern that arose or the practices that emanated from this was that in certain instances the education department never got these amounts. In other instances, when the provincial treasury had made the allocations, sums were taken away to deal with roads, clinics, and so forth. So what was originally intended for education never occurred. Now the grant has been put under the stewardship of by National Treasury to DBE, who will provide that. So in certain instances, some provinces are for the first time going to realize the actual allocation they should be getting. However, we are also finding a perverse situation occurring that as we have this 5 billion available, the equitable share seems to be diminishing in certain provinces, which was never the intention. We are looking at working on that to address and correct it. So the purpose of the conditions for this grant is the Schedule 4, which now will not go via the provincial treasury but go directly to the provincial education department. They are concerned, they are conditioned in terms of to prevent these to be used to pay personnel and so forth. It will cover the construction of new schools, additional spaces, upgrading and rehabilitation of existing school infrastructure, and maintenance of new and existing school infrastructure. This is basically the schedule of the transfers. It's actually four installments. The first installment is divided into two. We have the first installment on the 1st of April. That will not happen on the 1st of April. It will happen as soon as the DORA is enacted. That payment will take place just to give provinces some money to kickstart those projects that they are starting. What is the monitoring mechanism that is being utilized? Currently, the infrastructure reporting model used by Treasury for all infrastructure is used by the DBE and the provincial education departments. We are going to enhance the IRM and customize it to better suit the education sector. In addition to that, the table B5 of the provincial budget statements, which will have the list of the projects that the provinces will be conducting, we will request the minister to gazette that, which will mean that we are basically then obliged, and the public will know that these are the projects that need to be completed. The table itself, B5, will be aligned to the IRM planning project list, and there will be a schedule of quarterly visits to compare and verify what is being reported on against actual delivery. DBE is increasing its capacity to ensure that it can report and monitor more thoroughly. In addition to this, we are reporting on a monthly basis to the minister in terms of the infrastructure projects in a written form. In the case of the Eastern Cape, this has become every second week, and we also have to report to the minister on a weekly basis as well in terms of progress. These projects for the 2011-12 year, in particular the mud schools, would have to be completed by 31st March, and we should be seeing schools being completed as we go into the third and fourth quarter. Failure is not an option, as our DG has indicated. You'll probably find that if that is the situation, you'll have new faces reporting to you. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Padachi. Anything to add, DG?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Any questions that members would like to ask? Starting with Honourable Anakul, on your side, Honourable James. And just hold on, Vanchana, Honourable, and then Kubela, and then Honourable Smiles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the project here is a fabulous project, and it is very good that that finance, that Treasury has set aside money to deal with infrastructure backlogs. And you would know better than I that it's easier to implement this in some parts of the country compared to others. We know what the story is in the Eastern Cape and the high concentration of mud schools and so on. So having robust systems of delivery from the procurement side, the tender side, the appointment of contractors, the monitoring of contractors, ensuring the normal thing, ensuring that the money gets to where it should on time, so that the actual construction happens. And then once it happens, the maintenance of the buildings clearly downstream require ongoing management systems on ground level. So if you can just take me, I would really would like you to take the committee step by step through that entire process in terms of how you're going to implement this in the most difficult parts of the country. And we understand the history here, The Eastern Cape had no, it has to deal with two old Bantustans in it. There was no proper management systems from the very start and so on and so forth. And you see also with Northwest the same problem. All those struggling provinces did not have the advantage the Western Cape had, for example, of an integrated administrative system from the very start in 1994. KwaZulu-Natal also had a relatively... Anyway, that's the history. So how are you going to make sure that this thing happens in a way that ensures that the children sitting in the classroom actually get what they should be getting?
Circle Chair, first, just to appreciate this report, which gives more clarity to what is happening on the side of infrastructure. Just three questions of clarity.
I know on the third one, Roman figure 3, you don't have a number, but on the following page or pages, there's somewhere you've got figures. Does it mean that that's the overall number of the mud structures? Because once you say entire, it means conclusively it will be 395. So one come here some other time to realize that it's 400 structures, for instance. So I'm just asking, I want us to be clear on it. When we're saying entire, does it mean that we've audited nationally and the number is 395? And the same should apply to the inappropriate structures. I think somewhere you're talking 74, replacement of 74 entire inappropriate structures. And if there's still need to do some work on that, I think you should explain. The second issue would relate to who takes overall responsibility. Will it be the Department of Basic Education? So, for instance, Public Works is out of this whole implementation, so that if things do not go well, the buck stops with you and no other department. The last point, it's on the grant conditions, where you're talking supplementary grant and so on. The second bullet talks construction of new schools and additional spaces. What would refer to these additional spaces, for instance? What are we talking about? Because I take it that every word here or concept has got cost implications. So meaning that additional spaces are going to be funded, and what will that be constituted?
It's a search for the form.
got the data from the provinces, so that must know which province need the new schools, and then the applicating of that thing. And again, I heard that the presenter was talking about there was an allocation that is going to pay additional teachers. And then I don't think we're going to get an outcry in future, because you said there is an allocation for paying additional teachers. If maybe I heard you well, sir, you'll just clarify me. And then I think other questions. Thanks a lot. Will someone reply from the department?
Thank you, Mr. Fariachi. We'll start and then I'll come in afterwards.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with the last one about the teachers. What I referred to is that we're looking at a total package. We're basically responsible for building the school. But that doesn't mean that there is delivery at the end of the day. You can build the best school, but it means nothing if the child doesn't have a teacher and so forth. And I'm not referring to any additional allocation. Basically, we'd be expecting that the other line functions with their budgets would need to ensure that the desks and chairs are purchased, that if there's a teacher required, the teacher is allocated and sent there. And if that has to come out of the existing budget or the need, that is a process that will be outside the jurisdiction of the infrastructure function. But what we're saying is we want a total solution that when you leave the school, you're not going to say, I'll be back, and then you come back in 10 years. That is what we're looking at. So you'll have a fully functional school, and then the issue then is about, from an infrastructure point of view, is the maintenance to ensure that we do not go back towards a backlog. I think that's the... what we meant. The other one referring to the additional spaces is basically the fourth strand, which refers to the core spaces of libraries, laboratories, and admin blocks. There are schools that are, the infrastructure is sound, but they don't have this facility. So that's why the word is additional, and this would need to be prioritized from the provincial education budgets. We do not have that information here presently. The request was made that this information be made available. As I indicated, after the 8th of April that it will be there, and we're also gazetting it, so it will be public knowledge, and we will make that available to you. I'm working actually backwards. The Honorable smiles. We know that, that IDT has been referred. There's been a presentation to Parliament by IDT and Public Works on the $2.7 billion where they were involved. What we're saying is that IDT is not our sole provider. It's the first 50. We're not functioning in the manner we functioned in the past. Even the service delivery agreement itself is looking at there would be penalties in that regard, which was not contemplated because IDT was seen to be part of the government. So they are stringent. There are also other alternatives if IDT didn't come to the party. The other 50 that would need to be done in the remainder would be, we referred yesterday to the World Cup lessons of looking at the Big Bang as well. That could be also, that has also been considered in the process. But to get moving, because we've been in the planning and we need to show, we haven't laid a single brick, but by May we should be showing that there's something happening and IDT will be put to the test. IDT has delivered in certain instances, but I think under proper, correct management and terms, we need to ensure they are just like any other service provider. The same applies to Public Works. While we don't mention them, Public Works, if it delivers in terms of what our requirements are, we will use them because the end result is to ensure that the children have the proper infrastructure. Who takes overall responsibility? Basically, it will be the Department of Basic Education, that's the minister and the MECs as a sector, and DG is, after the MEC is responsible, and then it's Perry Pediachi and his team thereafter that's responsible. We will not come here and tell you that the province didn't deliver. It will be that the education sector didn't deliver. And there will be a political accountability, there will be administrative accountability for that. The equitable share, I didn't mention, the equitable share is in a The preliminary statements are being presented, available, but is approximately 3.4 billion. There is being, will be tabled in terms of the provincial budgets, which we will, when the information is available and the list, will account for it. What we indicate is not that, what we're saying is that provinces are supposed to budget through their portion of the education budget for infrastructure. These grants came about because it was insufficient. It now seems like they seem to be taking away the responsibility from funding this. We basically will be doing an analysis of this, like, for example, in the Eastern Cape. Over 900 million is made up of the infrastructure grant, the 968, and then there's just another 400 million in from the equitable share. Of that 400 million, only less than 100 million goes to schools. So you're not going to be able to address the needs of maintenance and so forth if that is the, if we were not involved in this. We're looking to rectify that as we go on. We need to ensure that we have a track record in terms of implementing. If that is there, then the required amounts required to provide school infrastructure, in particular maintenance, will have to be, will then be provided to us in terms of the proposal. Then to come to the issue, the 700 million is a separate amount. The 5.5 is a separate amount. So we're talking about over 6.1 billion. That's from the grants. And then when you had 3.4, these are all the money that will be, that's, that is there for us in the 2011 year. So we're talking of over 9 billion rand that we will spend over this period in 2011 and 12, and we must account for it, and not just in financial terms, but to show that the structure is there and it is of a sound nature that will stand for 10 to 20 years. So I think that's why it's 700 plus 5.5 billion. To go to the issue of what is the, what I refer to is what the process is. I think we're not doing justice here, but I'll just start this, and the next time we do come with the details, and we will indicate. From our perspective, is we have looked at, if you're looking at Eastern Cape in particular, we have looked at their infrastructure. The mud schools is one area, and we refer to entire mud schools. What will occur is that there are schools that will have 12 classes of brick and mortar, and then on the other hand, have two mud. We're not involved in that, but through the provincial budget, in time we'll need to replace those as well. And that's what they are referred to as inappropriate, but not the entire school is inappropriate. So I think we're talking about these 395, and we should not see an entire mud school thereafter. Once we've completed this or in the process, some of them will be dealt with in terms of additional spaces and so forth. But the focus is on the replacing the entire mud schools. On the, going back just to the building cycle process, is that we've verified what it is that would be required. In the Eastern Cape in particular, while 2.7 billion have been allocated countrywide, the mud schools have been eliminated elsewhere, but not in the Eastern Cape. Is we verified what their needs are, and from this we've now done the verification. We now into selecting a service provider for the 50. Then that would mean that the service provider would have to agree terms to us, and then they would go out to procure. The terms would be that these schools need to be completed in the 12 month, and then the building cycle kicks in. That there will be also community involvement in terms of consulting with the community as to the schools that are being built. Thereafter, the plans will be designed. In fact, we have standard designs that have been developed, and thereafter, you get into the building process. And then there will be handover of the school, but 10% of the amount will be retained for a 12-month period. So the contractors will not get that full amount. So we will probably sit with, of the 770 million because of the retention clauses.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. If I might add, with your permission, Mr. Pariachi has answered all the questions. I just want to add to some of them, starting off with the Honorable James's question with regard to the key priority being to deliver, to ensure that children have access to schools. That's a key thing. And clearly, we're doing a lot of work to ensure that from procurement to project management to implementation to monitoring construction to actual maintenance thereafter is covered properly. But there are a few important principles here. If you look at this amount of money being spent in an economy, we must recognize that this is how government impacts very seriously on how markets work. And we've got to be very conscious of that. If we procure inefficiently, we don't then encourage competition in the market, and therefore government ends up paying high prices, and we end up having inflated prices in the market. If anybody tried to build a house during or after the World Cup, you'd realize that despite a property market that was lethargic, it was very expensive to construct. It's because prices were inflated in that time. We have to be aware that we are influencing the market. Even though we're educationists, every decision we make impacts on the construction industry in this regard. We're also aware that if we are not clear and predictable in the amount of money we release and when we release it, the construction industry suffers severely because they've got to plan ahead. Some of them have migrated offshore because of this problem. So we're very aware that this has to happen. We're also aware that we've got to have scrupulous fairness so that every provider has a fair opportunity to win a tender, and also we've got to ensure that quality is achieved. In that regard, as Mr. Padiachi has indicated, when we work with Public Works or IDT, we treat them as a service provider now, not a co-government department. We are the procuring department. They have to deliver, right? We are their client. And if they don't deliver in accordance to specification and expectations, they get penalized like any other provider gets penalized. That is new. It's no more we hand over to Public Works, they procure, and they tell us, you know, what's happened. That we are the client, and the buck stops with us, as Mr. Padiachi has indicated. Furthermore, we've looked very carefully and learned lessons from government procurement modalities, and it's clear that even though they're strict, it's very easy at times for these to be manipulated. We learned with Treasury's input different risk factors. And based on a risk analysis, for example, we did with the workbooks tender, we realized that we needed to do certain things. For example, bring in the Auditor General, bring in external auditors, bring in the National Treasury. And those are ways in which you address some of the risks that could exist. And in that regard, in that example, it was clear that we managed to mitigate huge risks. Now, we thought that budget was big. This budget is even bigger. Therefore, along the way, including at the procurement stage, it won't just be DBE officials doing the procurement under any circumstances. It will be DBE officials with the Auditor General, with the Treasury, and with independently appointed credible auditing companies who have a statutory obligation to exercise fairness. That's what auditors are supposed to do. If they don't, you can report them and they can be jailed for not meeting their professional expectations. So that's what how serious this matter needs to be dealt with. So we're not, even if a procurement happens in a province, we'll ensure that this happens. Now, not to delay the process, but to make sure it happens. Furthermore, again, to build on what Mr. Padiachi said, in the past, and this links to Mr. Smell's point, when somebody failed to meet the specifications of a tender, they weren't punished necessarily. And what happened, that provider came back into the market. Here we're quite clear. In fact, if we don't punish, we ourselves will get into trouble because it's part of the specifications. As Mr. Padiachi has indicated, it comes back to us that so-and-so, whether it's IDT, Public Works, or a big contractor, or a small contractor, if they've not performed according to specification, we have to penalize or otherwise show why we're not penalizing. And in that way, we're hoping to create efficiency in this delivery. We would be lying if we say we're not nervous about this. This is a big task. But we've tried a whole lot of different ways to do this thing. And now we're saying emphatically we are going to approach it in this manner. And this manner means we've got to go big. I must point out, Honorable Chairperson, here today, that we've received huge assistance from the National Treasury in terms of their procurement unit, the anti-corruption unit, their infrastructure unit. Huge assistance from the AG. They, in fact, initiated a meeting with me to say, how can we help? And provinces. So there's huge interest in this thing to make sure that it happens. And as Honorable James has said, we can't then procure and wait. We've got to monitor as construction happens so we pick up problems. We've learned in this country where sometimes you pay for a project and then you go and see the roof hasn't been built or the doors can't close. We've got examples of that. Some school blocks aren't being used because they've been declared unsafe. In some instances, the doors don't close or don't open. Now, that is all built into this process, which is why we've asked for Treasury and they've given us money for project management of this thing by independent professionals. We're hiring engineers. We're educationists. We're hiring engineers to do this thing. And then right through, again, an important point Honorable James has put his finger on, is if you construct a model school and you don't put a maintenance budget, man, that school can deteriorate in a very short space of time. So built into this process is that maintenance budget. So clearly, this is something with the infrastructure matter that's occupying a lot of our time, and there's been a lot of planning already to get us to this point where we're ready for the 2011-12 implementation. Thank you, ma'am.
Any follow-up questions? Honorable James, Justice, no one else? Thank you, sir.
Hello, thank you very much, and thank you for the detail. It sounds like you've taken care of everything. When it comes to tenders, are you going to make the tenders a public thing? That is, would you put it on your website?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Yes, in fact, the prescripts are clear. It has to be public. But the point we're making is we're not going to simply comply with the minimum prescripts. We're going to go beyond that. So in addition to making it public and so forth, all the advertising, everything will be monitored by independent auditors to make sure that we indeed make it public. It's available through the public newspapers, website, bulletin, etc. Thank you, Chair.
Under basic services, what isn't it to put for KwaZulu-Natal not having a electricity project? I didn't hear that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bariachi, it's about KZN for basic services in terms of the budget allocation. Why is there...
I see there's no...
No allocation.
Electricity project there.
Electricity, yeah.
What I indicated is that as part of the CD, the province has already got projects for electricity which it's funding from its own budget, from the provincial budget. It doesn't mean that there are no schools that still have to be covered. And other provinces whose allocations appear there? Well, it has to be, it's dependent on the amount of money that has been available. Western Cape and Gauteng are quite close to universal electrification, but the others, dependent on the amount of money that is available, that those are the projects that they will cover. It's split between electricity, water, and sanitation.
May I, Honourable Chair, please? Let me just reassure the Honourable Member. A province doesn't suffer because they have allocated money to do their work. In fact, we need to do the opposite. And I can hear your concern that if KZN is now allocated for electrification, are we going to punish them by not including them in this process and reward those who have not made the allocation to deal with electricity? KZN is a poor province. It doesn't work that way. We have an allocation, and we make sure all provinces get their fair share according to their needs, not just according to the size of the population. So if KZN have put their money elsewhere, we reward them in another area. Similarly, if a province suddenly steals the money from infrastructure and takes it away, that's the opposite of what you're raising. We make sure we work on that matter for that money to come back into school infrastructure. So I can rest assured that you can be rest assured that a province is not going to suffer because they're already allocating optimally in their own budgets for infrastructure.
Are you satisfied, Honourable Member, with the answer?
Thank you.
Right, fine. I think what's going to be important, DG, because like if you look at DORA, they give you their outputs when it comes to infrastructure over the next MTEF period. And I think it's going to be very important for the committee because to know how many unsafe structures do we have in South Africa. Because I think when it comes to mud structures, it's not only the Eastern Cape, I read somewhere else that I'm not sure if it was KwaZulu-Natal or what province. So that will be important that we know, you know, what are you covering. We look at this, I'm looking at the 74 that you speak about when it comes to prefabs. You've got the 395 for the mud structures. 100 have to be done in this financial year. 24 replacements of inappropriate, and you say it. And when a person look at one province only, they have more than this unsafe. Because if you look at the previous department, the Department of Representatives, I think the one that we belong to, the majority of the schools are prefabs. And the prefabs is about 50 years old, and we know that it's supposed to, the lifespan is 15 years. So I think it will be interesting to know what is the total of unsafe structures, and you put down, these are mud, these are plank, these are that. And then the other thing that happens when it comes to reprioritization, then certain schools fall out. So a person has to be careful when you reprioritize, because I know schools that was supposed to be rebuilt in 1996, and it's still the same. So just give us a full report, and I'm satisfied with that implementation plan you're giving. Thanks a lot, Sernie. Any other questions on program four? Because they have the, it's management and planning information, management systems, assessment and public examinations, and then the National Education Evaluation and Development Unit. Any questions on four? Because we want to talk about the big thing there. All right. Yes. Yes. Honorable Smiles.
Yeah. I see that the second biggest allocation is to national assessment and public examinations. And then if you look at the economic classification, then there are two major spending under current payments. Can the department explain the spending of 15 million on, say 16 million on inventory and stationery and printing? And then the other one, travel and subsistence. Page 17. Yeah. Excuse me?
Where are you looking at?
Page 17, under...
Yes, but see, was this presentation you're looking at?
No, I'm looking at the...
Oh, the other one.
Yeah, the vote. The vote. This one, yeah.
It's under economic classification. Were you able to answer Mr. McGinchy?
Sorry, ma'am.
It's on page 17.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes.
Economic classification. And then what are we looking at there?
I'm looking on, yes, the, yeah, and travel and subsistence. Yes, it's 23, yeah, million. Chairperson,
yes.
May I just add to that question? Can there be more specifics with regard to grade R? Since early childhood development is one of your performance indicators. Yeah, thank you.
Grade R in special schools. Look at page 18 too, where they speak about, you know, mainly due to additional allocations for grade R and special schools infrastructure over the period. You find it, madam? All right, you can reply.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. This is the branch where examiners and moderators are. So the high travel and accommodation and subsistence is for moderators and examiners when they go and set the papers, for instance, when they go to the department. And printing is also related to the examination unit as well as the annual national assessment. Thank you.
And in the link that I asked,
we'll cover that.
The grade R basically crosses the department as well, but with regard to Program 4, is to look at extended funding. Presently, grade R is funded at 70% of the grade 1 cost of a learner. And the argument is that the 70% that is being funded has to take care of all your materials as well as the subsidy or the stipend that's paid to the teacher, the practitioner as well. So the work that has to be done is to look at ensuring there's adequate funding in terms of the grade R, in terms of the materials that need to be provided, which includes infrastructure. Presently, there's a grant that had to deal with providing classrooms for grade R. This may require more to reach universality. Will require more funding in that regard. The other is to look at whether the grade R practitioner is also a qualified educator. And if it is a qualified educator, then the cost of the personnel is a different amount. So that's the work that is part of it, dealing with the norms and standards and the funding in that regard for this program.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I might just add to that by way of clarification to the Honourable Member's spouse. The actual expenditure for grade R will be on the provincial budget, not on our budget. So if we're looking at the expression of grade R being a priority and how much of money goes into it, we aggregate that from provincial budgets because that's where actual delivery happens. What we do generally is the setting of the frameworks, the norms and standards and so forth. So just to clarify that aspect. And when we speak about the sector budgets, that's where we can see whether we're prioritizing grade R, et cetera.
Thanks a lot for that, Dean Chair. Honourable James?
I'm not quite sure where this falls, but the whole issue of the marking centres and their distribution in the country is clearly an issue. I mean, Mpumalanga has, I don't know how many marking centres, 22, for the same number of learners as the Western Cape has. And it raises all kinds of questions about supervision and monitoring of marking, and you know the story. What are you... How are you going to deal with that issue? And is it included in the budget? Yeah.
Chair and DJ, I see there's an allocation to provinces and municipalities. Probably it's either with regard to payment of services in that regard, but you'll elaborate on that. But within the same breath, I know that there's an outcry in the country by municipalities that departments are not paying for services, probably education included, that most schools don't pay. How do you explain this allocation to municipalities yourselves when there is this outcry? Thanks.
Thanks a lot for that. Because the thing is, just like I know, the schools have a paper budget. But when it comes to electricity, that amount given is not enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. In terms of Honourable James's question about marking centres and their distribution, that is a matter that is funded by provinces, but it is a huge concern in the way you've articulated it. We increasingly, with Umalusi's input, are becoming aware of and concerned about supervision over marking centres. Therefore, this year, as part of our monitoring exercise, which we routinely conduct to prepare for the examination in that year, we're paying particular attention to marking centers, the supervision, and the integrity of marking there. We've also, yesterday at HEDCOM, discussed competencies for markers. We're trying to tighten that up. We're trying to tighten monitoring, because in some of the far-flung areas where marking centers exist, we are convinced that supervision of the marking there may not be at the level we want it to be. So Honourable Member is absolutely correct. It's a concern that we are going to address. And you've got to there strike a balance between devolution and reducing the numbers so that you can supervise properly. So we're dealing with that one. Nokubela, in terms of municipal services, what you see on our budget is the amount we pay to the municipality for services. We don't have in our budget what the schools and provinces pay. So that you'll find in the provincial budgets. But you do raise an important issue emphasized by the chair, that there is a problem of government institutions, including schools, paying their rates and services. And the Honourable Chair has put a finger on it. Sometimes it's about the adequacy of the money that school gets. Sometimes it's the decisions they make. So there's that side of the problem, which is a big problem. There's another side of the problem, though, where municipalities know that there's certain institutions they can use as cash cows. And because schools are government, we found that they actually levy very high rates on schools and government institutions. So on the one side, we are unfair to municipalities. On the other side, they are unfair to us. Over the years, we've been debating with them to say, really speaking, can you justify this level of rates for schools, especially poor schools? But they do that. If you look at the water bill for a school, the electricity bill, the rates and taxes bill, it's not just, you can't justify the level at which it's given. And that's another area we've been engaging in. And they've been honest with us. They said, look, if we don't do this, we run into revenue problems because we can't force some of the residents to pay like we can get schools to pay. So it's an issue that we're trying to solve, and it's been an issue that's been around for a few years. And we're trying to deal with it with the Cooperative Governance, Department of Cooperative Governance as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I think let us go on to Program 4, and we're looking at the school nutrition. But I think the next time when you meet the department, we have to speak to the technical schools grant. Not now, the next time. Let's go to Program 5 and look at school nutrition.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Morning, Honorable Members. I'm going to speak on the National School Nutrition Program. The objectives of the program are threefold. The one is to contribute to teaching and learning by ensuring that learners receive nutritious meals, and we do that through working with provinces and our districts. The second objective is to strengthen nutrition education for school communities and for schools themselves. And the third one is to promote sustainable food production initiatives in schools in order to develop skills. And so the program is based on three pillars: feeding, nutrition, education, and sustainable food production. The school feeding pillar, in terms of the school feeding pillar, we reach over 8 million learners with priority schools in quintiles 1 to 3, primary schools, and quintiles 1 and 2, secondary schools. As honorable members would know, from April 2011, we will be adding quintile 3 secondary schools. The emphasis over time has been on ensuring quality nutritious meals. When we started the program, the emphasis was on access, ensuring that as many poor learners access meals. But over the years, we've placed much more emphasis on the quality of the meal that they receive, and we've ensured that the meals are provided on all school days. We've also strengthened the capacity of the provinces and the districts in terms of monitoring. Our special emphasis, as you will see from our plans, is on monitoring. It has, in some of the instances, been a weak pillar, but moving forward, that's the one key responsibility that we have identified. And the second area of emphasis has been the transfer of funds to schools. I've indicated in the past to honorable members that the we have found through our studies and through some of the provinces that that give money directly to schools, that the program is much more efficiently implemented, the rent stretches more, and the quality of food is better because the schools procure from the communities around themselves. But also that the communities themselves, the governing bodies, play a much more vigorous role in ensuring that the money is spent for what it's intended for. In terms of nutrition education, we've created awareness on healthy food choices so that it's not just about feeding, but that children are aware on what choices they make in terms of the food choices. We've developed through the curriculum materials to support life skills and life orientation to support nutrition education. Sustainable food production, schools that are feeding and those that are not feeding are encouraged to establish food gardens. There are obviously challenges that relate to the soil, that relate to the seeds, etc., but there is a concerted effort to ensure that schools have food gardens, and they play two roles. The one, they supplement the meals that are provided, but we also, schools use them to provide skills for learners, so they become they supplement the curriculum in various ways. The evolution of the NSNP, over time, in the past we used to provide cold menus, now we've moved to cooked menus. The quality of the food was uneven in the past. We, as I've indicated earlier, we're concentrating now on the improving the quality of the meals. In the past, the learners were selected within schools. We used a system called targeting, which had quite a number of problems. One, the biggest of which was stigmatizing some of the learners. And now we've moved to quintiling and to targeting schools, whole schools. Coverage, we started with primary schools. As you can see, we've now moved to secondary schools. We're now in quintile 3. We've listed some of the best practices that we've found both in the schools but also in the provinces. We have a best practice booklet. We have a recipe book which was developed by our volunteer providers. We had last year the NSNP Best Schools Awards, and the budget for school nutrition has steadily increased to reach more learners. I've included a slide. The expenditure is at February 2011, not 2010. I apologize for that mistake. The expenditure is, as you can see it, from up until February, clearly doesn't include some of the invoices from February and March that would increase some of the expenditure then. The allocations I've also included. Eastern Cape, Limpopo and KZN have the largest because of the number of poor learners in those provinces. We think we're on track with expenditure, and it's been one of the improvements within the grant of ensuring that provinces are spending at the rate that is required. In fact, Treasury has indicated that there has been significant improvement in the administration of the grant. Our plans for 2011, the DG has already indicated that we're looking at monitoring the grants differently. We're placing a lot of emphasis on ensuring that it's not just monitoring, but it's also support and intervening where it's necessary. And we're monitoring it in collaboration with other directorates so that each and every directorate or branch that goes to a school, they also check on what is happening around school nutrition, especially around the quality of the meals. But we're also using communities and stakeholders much more vigorously than we have been in the past, because they are better able to be our eyes and ears. We also looking at providing minimum allocations to provide utensils and equipment, especially for the primary schools that did not have equipment. You will know that with the secondary schools, the prior to the year of feeding, we had provided the allocation for utensils and equipment, and we're trying to provide the same for primary schools. Our ultimate aim, as I've indicated, is to ensure that the money goes directly to the schools for the reasons I've stated earlier, and we're working with the provinces and the districts to ensure that the schools are better able to manage the funds and the transfers. So putting systems in place so that schools are able to report much more efficiently, but they're also able to know what is expected of them. The chairperson has just alluded to a report around technical schools. We're looking at a project management approach around the management of all conditional grants so that we're able to monitor them better, to implement better, and to respond much better. And the approach will incorporate all of the grants that are being allocated to the department, and once we're ready, we'll come back to the committee with that. Lastly, we're aligning all of our school nutrition program activities with the curriculum because we believe that the curriculum is the best way to communicate the programs, and we're strengthening partnerships to improve areas of need and recognizing excellence and best practice. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for this. Are there any questions? Fine. Honourable James, Honourable Smiles. Anyone else? Oh, I've been seeing you. Fine. And Makubela. Honourable James.
For many children, the school meals is the only good meal for the day. And so it's absolutely vital that that, of course, happens. And when I saw the suspension of the nutrition program in the Eastern Cape, I was horrified. Because, I mean, when it comes to children for food, it's nothing as emotional as that. My immediate response was that person should be fired. You know, there should be harsh consequences for anybody who suspends nutrition programs. So my question is not about the budget and not about what it is you're doing, because I think that's absolutely right, but the question is what's the accountability of the people who implement this?
With other people. I'm saying the expenditure in the Eastern Cape is at 82%, when in fact that program at some point was suspended. I'm just wondering how does it remain at par with other provinces when in fact they were not spending at some point. The second, I'm interested in understanding in provinces wherein, or even schools wherein the feeding is done by people around them, which is said to be best practice, what may be the other lessons which may be negative, if there's any? Because any system, when it's new and all that, before it gets to mature, there are issues. So that where there has not been such practice, they don't go through the same things which those provinces that started with this system might have come up about or come across, so that we get to learn in such circumstances.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to start about the private service providers, the companies who are delivering food at schools. I just want to know from the department, is there any plan maybe of improving this issue of service pro- because at some stage you'll find that they are delaying and learners, they are suffering in that score. And also on the issue of volunteering women or people who are cooking food, is there any plan that we have as department maybe to make sure that these women, at least they get something that will make them to work for us very openly and very good for that matter? Also, volunteerism is something else. You can get 10 cents or 20 cents or whatever, but is there any specific program or amount that is earmarked to us to make sure that these people are encouraged in their work? And also, on the issue of food gardens, in some areas there is no water. They feel to, in fact, they want to have these food gardens, but the problem of water really is stopping them not to have these gardens. Is there any plan in this department, in collaboration with the Department of Water, to make sure that maybe we come up with the program of boreholes in those schools that does not water or else? Thank you very much.
You may answer, madam.
Ms. Ndebele will start and I'll come in after.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Let me start with the issue of the expenditure in the Eastern Cape. And why it's on par. The issue in the Eastern Cape has always been that they've always had service providers that they've been paying who had been outstanding over time. So they've always had the challenge of overspending, which the reason for the suspension was anticipating that they were going to have overspending. But secondly, after the suspension happened, we then asked through the DG will speak to that, that the money be transferred to the schools directly. So the last two tranches of the resources were transferred to the school, with the last one having been done in the last week or so, which has increased the spending. I think you're right, Honorable Makubela, that with every initiative, there are challenges. With the handing over of the money to schools, it's obviously also related to the capacity of the schools to handle the resources themselves and the financial controls that they have available to them. But secondly, even the availability of the resources within those communities, of whether it's cooperatives, whether it's the food, you know, the food products within the communities. But with all of that, it's still the best options because it does deal with the issue that the Honorable Member was raising around service providers. Because if you get service providers that are far from the schools themselves, you deal with the issues of non-deliver on time, you deal with the issues of the quality of the food that has been delivered. So our view is that the program can also encourage the establishment of small MMEs, cooperatives, the ladies that the Honorable Member is talking about to form stock fells. So it can utilize a lot of the social groupings that we've traditionally had in our communities to provide a resource to the schools. And it will also deal with the issues of the payment of voluntary food handlers. Currently, as part of the program, there is a stipend that is provided to handlers, but it's clearly not enough, and it's always been our issue. But it is a budget issue. In terms of the food gardens, I agree with you. That's why I was saying ideally we would like to have it in all the schools, but we have the issues of water. We have the issues of seeds, etc. We, as part of the infrastructure plans, the obviously discussions with water affairs, but we also have in conversations with departments of agriculture to see how we mitigate some of the challenges that could arise. I think I've answered that.
Chairperson, I might just add in terms of the question on what James raised about holding people accountable. Indeed, that's what we intend to do In the case of Eastern Cape, the problem was caused by people other than the HOD who came in. And there's always a complexity one deals with in these situations, and especially in the Eastern Cape. There's been a problem. The problem hasn't been dealt with. New head of department comes in who tries to fix the problem. So clearly what we're doing now in terms of Section 100 is to look at all of these challenges that have taken place, and where we do find culpability to investigate it, and where it's necessary to then hold the right people accountable for that. But going forward in terms of the school nutrition program, we've identified that in the Eastern Cape and in other provinces, we need a very powerful, very robust risk management system. So in addition to risk management overall in the department, we'll specifically cater for risk mitigation with regard to school nutrition, especially now that we're devolving money to schools. In the case of the Eastern Cape, we're working on modalities for managing that risk in terms of the experience and in terms of the points Honorable James has raised and Honorable Makubela. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I think on this program, before we go off, it will be important for you to speak to HIV and AIDS because it's part of this program. Briefly, what program have you got in place? Then school safety, safe schools, it's a part of this program. You know, you can just speak briefly to that too because we're having a lot of violence at schools. And then when it comes to sexual violence, it falls into this program. You can speak to that. And I think there's a bit of sports there too. Speak to that, and then according to the estimate, you know, the book with the estimates in, you give in something to Childline to South Africa. Just speak to that. Thank you. Any other thing that anyone wants to know? Yes, Honourable. What's your answer?
I just want to know how the department has dealt with the problem of fronting by school principals, because it was a problem then, and the department was going to investigate and deal with the matter. I haven't since heard what the progress has been in that front. Thank you.
You may speak, ma'am. Sorry.
No, Chairperson, thank you. Chairperson, we cannot always ask questions. We must appreciate where the department is doing good. So our department is doing very well, especially in this program of food nutrition. It's excellent. Everybody on the ground, they accept it and they appreciate. Only Eastern Cape is a problem. If you can work on Eastern Cape, then we are fine 100%. Thank you very much.
Chairperson. Yeah, no, when things are good, you need to smile. And I've looked at the particular point where the director is reporting that the health issues are being addressed. That means page 18, once again in this document. Improve the health and performance of learners by facilitating the early identification and treatment of health barriers to learning of grade 1. Now, whilst that is very good and it's specific and it's focused, targeted, I'm just worried that, you know, if you only look at quintile 1, you may lose out other people, other learners that are maybe, you know, advantaged or more in a upper class, but there are still problems maybe with the nutrition at home, and that has a sort of a bearing in the classroom on them. So I would like the department to ask whether they cannot, you know, that limitation, look at it and maybe just have it overall. Yeah. Chairperson, and then I like this program, really. It's a good program because it looks at making conditions conducive for learning, and if we prosper here, yeah, we can go a long way. Now, but there's little money. That's the problem.
whilst I appreciate the SNP, but you cannot have this and say it, and there's no funds that will follow the function. So you need to improve. Otherwise, as I say, I love this. I will ask this committee, based on this, not to accept the budget or to make a change in the budget. Thank you, Chair.
Guideline on the prevention of sexual violence and abuse in schools,
which we've implemented we've distributed to all the schools, and we've worked with young people in ensuring that they're able to identify and report on issues of sexual abuse. And the partnership that we have with safety, with the Department of Safety, will ensure that they have access to police if they need any assistance. Again, underlying that is the need to ensure that the whole package of support is available for learners. And so with the Department of Social Development and the Minister of Social Development has already spoken to this, we're exploring the availability of social workers in a cluster of schools so that they're able to support learners. In terms of sports, the Minister of Education and the Minister of Sports met, and they've tasked us with the responsibility of developing an integrated school sports plan. We have done that, and it hinges on two pillars: the physical education. As you know, it is now an identifiable subject in the curriculum, which has always been the struggle around physical education because it's always been part of life orientation. But also that we looking at ensuring that we bring back school leagues in schools. And for this year, we'll identify a few codes to ensure that that is strengthened within the schools, and we'll grow them as the time goes on. We have been in discussions with federations to ensure that they support the program. So the plan, once approved by the ministers, will be presented to the portfolio committee. I agree with Honorable Smiles around the screening. The reason we started with grade one was purely a resource issue. And resource both in terms of finances, but also in terms of the availability of health professionals in the provinces. Health indicated to us that they have limited health professionals that could access the screening. But over time, we have been able to mobilize other partners in business, with the Optometrists Association, the Dental Association of South Africa, who Pillow Paper, who the train that goes. So our plan is to do exactly what Mr. Smith is saying, to look at first early identification, but also identification through the grades, because a lot of the learners have been missed over time. And together with the inclusive education section, we need to strengthen that. The DG will talk to the issue of the funds. Honorable Mponjana, we haven't been able to, as we indicated the last time, if there are any incidents of fronting that are reported, we are willing to deal with them, but we haven't been able to find any that we can report back to the community, to the committee.
Thank you. And I just want to make a correction. All members are honorable. Even Mr. Smiles belong to the DA. It's honorable Smiles. Thank you, DG.
The acting CFO will.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The question in relation to Bullet 1 under Program 5, that is the office of the DDG. The monitoring allocation and other allocation for your conditional grants and so on are in the other two sub-programs. This is just a sub-program for the DDG's office.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. All the questions have been answered. I just need to speak overall to the budget. And the point on what Smiles was raising about moving money, and just to build on what the acting CFO has said, the actual budgets for these programs need to be tracked in the provinces. Here, all we're budgeting for is the facilitation, norms and standards development work that we're doing. Therefore, if we move money from another program into this one, it won't really make a difference in any way to what's being spent in the provinces. We've budgeted enough here to exercise our stewardship, but included in that stewardship is to look at how we can create conditions for additional budgets in those areas. As Ms. Ndebele has indicated, part of our work here relates to the budget of the Department of Health It relates to the availability of professionals to undertake this work. It relates to creative partnerships with higher education institutions training these professionals. So I just thought I'd put that before the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. We're going to program one. We still have a question. All right, Amishishi.
Yeah, person, this Z form responsibilities, the right, a bundle of responsibilities. What is the cost? And I've seen there's nothing wrong with it. It's good. I just want to check the cost. If we supply this to five million learners at 10 cent per unit, then it's a lot of money. I'm just want to check so that if we get a sponsor rather than taking our own money on having this and spend the money on school sports safety and the others. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Clarity, I think it's the last clarity on Program 5. And in inclusive education, I think has been prioritized, but its allocation in the medium term is not so clear. And then my concern is with the regard of the delay in finalizing the development of the funding norms for inclusive education and special schools. Thank you, Chair.
Important. We need answers. Thank you.
I will respond to Honorable Smiles that in fact the Z-cards were funded by Lead SA, so they were sponsored. They were not from the departmental allocation.
What cost still do you know?
No, I don't.
I think when it comes to the cost, come back to us with it, please. And remember, 7 days. And I want no dialogue, please.
Mr. Perez, do you want to respond to the inclusive ed funding norms issue?
Honorable Chair, to report to the committee, draft proposal has been finalized and is being discussed in the department with the senior management in AAA. So we will see progress in 2011 on the funding norms.
Satisfied, members?
Can I add to that, perhaps, Honorable Chairperson? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I think just as Honorable Skusana has correctly congratulated government's efforts in rolling out the school nutrition program, on the area of inclusive education is where our track record is not good at all, and that we've got to acknowledge. It's linked to primarily funding problems that's there. And again, the funding issue you won't find in our budget. It's about provincial budgeting that makes the money available. What's available here that you see here is not for rolling out inclusive education. And that's one of the reasons why the funding norms has been a problem to get right, because, you know, it's clear what you can do in terms of norms, but whether the provinces will have the money to fund it is something you've got to be very careful about. So clearly here it's an area where it is a priority of government. We've got a white paper, but we've been finding it very difficult to implement. And that's why we're giving it priority attention this time round, to ensure that within the scope of what's possible in our budget, we can ensure that this is indeed a priority. Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson.
Thanks a lot, sir. I think what's going to be important, because you hear people spoke about more budget, and we can amend, but I think when it comes to 2012, 2013, bring the budget earlier to us, because the way we're doing it with Empowerment is not aligned to the financial year of government. So we sit with a problem. So we won't be able to do it now, but we can do it then. Because also said Uma Lucy have to come with their budget. But it will be 2012-2013. And I think I'd like to tell Mr. Smiles, it's easier to say and reject something. To me, it's department has work to do. And the PFMA says for that little bit of money, you have to work efficiently, effectively, and economically within these constraints that we are in. And seeing that we're referring to provinces Taltan, as did you just make a note that you should provide us with a quarterly progress report in respect of performances within provinces, just to help us with our oversight. It is a lot, but I think it's going to be important because we can oversight it with our next, when we can oversight it, we can put it within our program. Thank you. Let's go to the cross provisioning norms, and then we do it fall under administration one, where it would fall, program three. All right? I think you did that to us, so let us do program three, everyone. We're going to do program three now. You may start, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm going to be speaking on the post provisioning norms. Firstly, just to say the PPN is regulated in terms of the Employment of Educators Act 76 of 1998. The regulations linked to that determine that the MEC must create a pool of posts annually in accordance with funds available. Unions are consulted normally from around June to August of every year to share information on process. And I just want to emphasize, Chair, that it is not necessary to reach an agreement. Schools then receive their post establishments by end of September, and that is in preparation for the following year. In eight of the provinces, this process has proceeded smoothly every year, except for the Eastern Cape. They may miss the September deadline, but normally, by the time we start the new year, this has happened already. In the Eastern Cape, the PPN has not been fully implemented since 1998. And this, as you know, then results in unequal distribution of teachers. And some schools have more teachers than needed, and others have to employ teachers where they require the post. And I will explain the reason for the double parking. In some instances, it has resulted in double parking and therefore inflating the salary bill, as you know. Now, the Eastern Cape is an exception in this regard, as I've said already, because what happens in the Eastern Cape, normally part of the process will be done, but then during the either consultation or the other steps, the unions will disagree with the employer and the process is halted. An example is what we saw in 2005, where there was a special intervention team in the Eastern Cape, and the work was done. The post basket declared, letters written to schools, but in the process of having to implement that, the unions made it impossible for the department to implement. And in the way that this happened was, where you've given the post basket to schools and excess teachers have to be moved, the teachers did not move. Where it worked well was in schools that lost teachers by natural attrition, and you know then they got vacancies and then absorbed the excess teachers. And in that way, around 2005, we were able to manage some of the excessive salary bill. This year, again, for the first time, the posts have been declared. Letters were written to the schools, were sent out to the schools on the 4th of March, and we're having a meeting in the province this Friday to try and assist them with the process. It's after the others had done the process, but we're hoping that we will be able to assist the province to deal with it this time. Now, yesterday I spoke to a proposed new PPN. What I'd like to do is to start with where we are with the current PPN and what it seeks to do. Now, the current model is holistic and systemic, but what it doesn't do is that it's not sufficiently nuanced to cater for curriculum delivery per grade and per subject. It weights learners and based on that, distributes available posts proportionally among schools, and the responsibility then resides with the principal to decide how the posts are utilized within the school in accordance with the curriculum offerings in the school. Now, maybe just to explain a bit the issue of weighting, we weight learners in accordance to the subjects that are done. We know that some subjects need more space, like for instance, if you're looking at technical subjects, if you're looking at physical science, and also we weight learners in relative to safety requirements, and that's determined by the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Why we've proposed a new model and what we would seek to do with it. Firstly, it's intended to address problems that persist with respect to large class sizes. But also, we hope the model that we're putting on the table would respond better to curriculum needs and the utilization of teachers. Secondly, it's intended to address the needs of poorer schools by allocating redress posts as part of the original distribution and not post facto. Thirdly, it's meant to deal with post provisioning in small and multi-grade schools, the question that Honorable Khanyaho asked yesterday, by giving them more teachers. And also to address the management of staffing turbulence that's created by the annual learner number fluctuations, because it will be more geared towards curriculum and ensuring that there can be quality learning and teaching in the schools. Lastly, we're hoping that it would manage the issue of class size by linking the allocation of posts to actual physical classrooms. We know also that is another problem where on paper we look good, but because we don't have the actual classrooms to accommodate the teachers, you find that in fact it doesn't reflect in what is happening in the schools. Now, yesterday again we spoke to the fact that we're testing the model. What we're doing is testing with data that is presently being used with the current model to determine the effect on each school, because we don't want to simply implement and find that in fact it doesn't do what we want it to do. Because the primary intention is that it should lead to quality learning and teaching. And we're testing it also, we're running scenarios with existing funding, because we also don't want to bloat the budget unnecessarily. We're looking at existing funding, we're looking at whether it would need additional funding, and trying to see, you know, how doable this is. As I'm saying, the testing will help us ensure whether the revised PPN, firstly, will deliver the intended outcome, and whether it is financially doable. That's just a graph to show you what the current post-provisioning model, I mean, how post-PPN works in the schools and how it determines the educator-learner ratios. And as you will see, in 2005, the average learner, the educator ratio was 32.8, the maximum was 34.4, and minimum was 31.1, and you see the figures for 2009. What that hides, however, is the actual picture per school, because within that, we have schools that will have large classes of 40 and above, and we're hoping that with the new PPN, we will nuance it sufficiently so that we can deal with those issues as well. Thank you very much, DJ.
Thanks, Salah. That was very interesting. Any questions? Honorable Mashishi? Honorable Clow? Question one, is the department able to fill in the vacant posts? Two, at what job level is the problem experienced? And number three, what is the impact of unfilled posts on the service delivery by the department?
And lastly, what measures are in place to fill the vacant post in order to improve service delivery? Maybe the last one, I forgot. What progress has been made in finalizing the policy for learner transport and hostel provisioning? Does the department have the exact number of children who need scholar transport nationally to facilitate adequate budget allocation? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. On page 4 of the presentation, I just want to know, did the department consider a model that differentiates, say for instance, your foundation phase, the teacher-learner ratio at that level, say 1:20, and then maybe for the intermediate phase something else, and for the, say, secondary schools, another sort of ratio. And I know maybe the funds will not help us, but is there maybe research on that, of that nature, so that we know if we want to implement that kind of differentiated model, that we go and look for the funds? Because I believe that best practice over the years has shown that in the kindergarten, as I used to know, the lower or the grade foundation phase, if 1:20 or at least 1:25, not that's the sort of norm that we practice. So, yeah, that's my question. Thank you.
My question to the department. I'm looking at the proposed new model, and you know this management class size through the linking of the allocation of posts to physical classrooms. I want you to explain that. And now my problem when it comes to the result of the PPN, I think Mr. Smile spoke partly to it. When you look at this teacher-learner ratio, to me this is a farce you're showing us. Because within that educator, you're taking the principal and the deputy principal and the HODs, and then it's the level one teachers. So I think the department will have to look at a model where you're going to take into consideration that when it comes to the level one teacher, that if you say primary schools is 1:40, then it's going to be 1:40. In high schools, 1:35, let us start there with those ratios, then it has to be 1:35. So I think we have to refine it a bit more, the way Mr. Smiles has just put it into the different stages. Thank you, my answer. Yes, Honorable Makubela.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to certainty in that, for instance, the difficulties experienced by farm schools in particular, in which at times you find they qualify in terms of the post-provisioning that we had in the past, not the new one. You'll find a school that is got one or two teachers who must go to all the grades and so on, which used to be difficult. Is the new model being taken into consideration? Such issues. The second, public schools mostly are suffering under these circumstances, in that they are unable to have posts that may be created by the SGB and paid for. Most of them because they are poor. Only schools that are well-to-do, wherein there's a difficulty, they are able to create their own posts. I think you understand what I'm trying to talk about. They create what they call SGB posts and fund them. They can fund up to 5 or even find they've got up to 8-10 teachers over and above those the department eventually provided for. Now, the other schools can't do that, and therefore they've got their own challenges, and I think it's an urgent issue. The third one is that in the profession, there hasn't been absorption in larger numbers of new teachers. So the average age in the profession today, as we speak, is about 45, 50, somewhere there. So that you must project an exit and mass of a lot of teachers at some point, whether the profession will be able to absorb new people or teachers later on, it's something else. So I'm just saying, perhaps you can share with us how you hope to deal with that, because it's a time bomb of some kind. Thanks.
Thank you. And I think I read somewhere that there's about 3-4 maths and science teachers. Just tell us how the teachers are going to address that. Thank you. Maths and science. Thank you. Oh, on for James.
Madam Chair, are you taking general questions now on this, the program as a whole? No, I'm asking general questions in the area of Program 3.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I was curious about the salary bill for teachers in this overall budget. If you could tell me what that is.
Ms. Chebeka will answer first and I'll follow up.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and DG. I will try and answer Honorable Mashishi's questions, but I am not sure whether in terms of the vacancies she was speaking to the organization here or to the teachers. But I'll speak very briefly on issues of teachers and then DG will assist with that. The issue of filling of vacancies in the schools is and across the system in the teaching profession is a concern. And what we have set in place, guided by the Council of Education Ministers, is a monitoring of the filling of posts. We have, working together with the provinces, put together, compiled a profile of all of the posts that are vacant, principal posts that have not been filled, and how long they've been vacant, HOD posts that are vacant and how long they've not been filled, as well as teacher posts. And what is in place is we monitor quarterly whether those have been filled. The timeline for the filling of posts is 3 months and not longer, so that there is somebody within 3 months. If it's a substantive post and it's vacant, within 3 months it should have been advertised and filled. On Monday, we met with the heads of education, and there's been great, great progress in the filling of posts that by January were vacant. So that's an area of concern for us, and we'll continue to monitor it. In terms of Honorable Smile's questions around the PPN, just to confirm that indeed what we are looking at is looking at this PPN, the new PPN, addressing, if you look at what is on there, we're saying one of the things that we're responding to is that the current PPN doesn't sufficiently look at issues of curriculum delivery per grade, per subject. So we are looking at what you would need in the foundation phase as opposed to what you would need in the intermediate phase and in the FET phase. What DG I would like to propose is that at an appropriate time we come and present to this committee the full proposal and what we're looking at. This presentation doesn't do that. It is very summarized. The chairperson, you asked that I should respond to the question of why we're saying we're linking the PPN to the actual physical classroom. It brings in a whole lot of things. It brings in the issues of the curriculum, the grades, and what is appropriate PPN for that level. But also one of the things that we found in the system is that we will do a paper exercise based on the numbers of learners in the school and what is needed. And you find that, in fact, in a school that has 17 classrooms, you have a staff of 35. and at any given point, half of them are not in the classroom, which doesn't help. So we've got to engage with all of those things to make sure that, in fact, we make optimum use of the people that we have. So that's the first thing. And you are correct that in that respect, then, the PPN that we present there, which is based on the old model, is really just a, it doesn't speak to the issues that we want to speak to, that will ensure that for all of the curriculum offerings, we have the relevant educators as needed, and those are the things that we're trying to address through the new PPN. And Honorable Makubela asks for certainty that, in fact, we are looking at ensuring, and I do make the point that what we're trying to do is to make sure that even your small and multi-grade schools have the teachers that they need to actually make teaching meaningful. And with the current PPN, because we're looking at the level at which we are, you do find those scenarios where sometimes even that one teacher is actually the principal. He's the principal and he's got to do all of the teaching, and those are the things that we're seeking to address through the new PPN. And likewise with your SDB posts, because what we're saying is that as a system, we have an obligation not to force schools to go out and employ, you know, and pay additional teachers. We must cater for what they need, you know, comprehensively. And we're looking to see whether, in fact, through this new PPN, we can do that. I will leave out, is there anything else that I haven't... for the bursary for math and science teachers, that's, you know, in the Funza Lushaka, that's part of the Funza Lushaka. Funza Lushaka is not a broad bursary. It's a bursary that targets particular areas of great need in the system. Maths and science, foundation phase, particularly foundation phase in your in indigenous languages, but our policy does identify those subjects where we, you know, we will give bursaries, and they are prioritized. And the question that you ask about how students access that, it links to the question that was asked, I think, by Honorable Makubela yesterday, how children, particularly children from poor schools, get to know about the bursary. And I think it's something that we continuously need to improve on. But at the moment, we do send information to schools. Thank you, teacher.
For your answer, I think there's questions of the Honorable Mashishi that was not answered. Because remember that in the State of the Nation address, the President spoke to that all posts have to be filled within the next 3 months. And, just speak to the department's vacant posts, because if your vacant posts have an impact on service delivery, because you can see what teachers do. If you don't have teachers there, it have an impact on service delivery. I know who's going to answer that. Oh, the DG. All right. Thank you. And then the other, I'm not sure where that falls in here, the policy on learner, transport, and then the hospital provision,
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Mr. Pariachi will deal with the scholar transport hostel policy progress, and I'll deal with the remaining questions. Mr. Pariachi, through Chair.
Thank you, DG. Honourable Chair, the learner transport policy has been drafted and finalized by the Department of Transport, and the issue that needed to be resolved was the location, whether it was in education or in transport. And the Minister has directed that education, there is no issues dealing with the policy that's been finalized by the Department of Transport, that with regard to the location, each province would take a decision on whether the function should be transferred or not. Already there are provinces that have transferred the function, there are others that are managing it on its own. And where there are provinces that do transfer, there should be a service level agreement in place to ensure that the standards for delivery are met and the funds to be transferred to the Department of Transport for the required number that would have been identified. So that is basically with regard to the policy, learner transport policy. The hostel policy has been drafted and is in circulation to HODs and provinces for their comments. and that will be then tabled at HEDCOM and CEM for their approval to publish for public comment in the next few months. With regard to the numbers, we do have, we can provide information on the numbers of the learners that are currently transported. The work that is to be done, we are proceeding with this year, and already we're looking at in Eastern Cape, is the demand that will be required beyond what we are currently providing for learners at present. And this we can make available when we complete the task.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. With regard to Honorable Mashishi's question, we need to distinguish between the department's vacancies, which will fall under Program 1, and then vacancies in the system, which is largely educators, which falls under this program. Now, as far as educators is concerned, that's not our direct responsibility. It's the responsibility of provinces, but we do monitor that. Now, clearly there are a number of factors that shapes how fast vacancies are filled. One is about process and about the role of SGBs, the role of unions, and so forth in that regard. It varies from province to province and from school to school, but largely provinces are succeeding in reducing the lead time to filling a vacancy. We still have problems where certain SGBs try to use the power given to an SGB to determine the kind of teacher they want, which is not necessarily based on purely educational grounds and equity grounds. So that is a problem we still face in that regard. Over and above that, we do have a problem in terms of the scarce subjects, in terms of recruiting appropriately skilled teachers to deal with that. And that is linked to the implementation of PPM. Because you see, honorable members, if you have an excess educator and you have to move that educator to a vacancy, the chances are there's not a clear match between the excess educator and the vacancy. You can't simply take that excess educator and put them into a vacancy. Look at the Eastern Cape situation at the moment. Indications are, and we have to confirm it with accurate data, but indications are that a large number, not a large number, a significant number of the excess educators are not good matches to the vacancies. You can't send a primary school educator in excess into a senior secondary school vacancy. You are going to compound your problems. Therefore, then you go to the next step, which is say, do you have a severance tool for that educator if you can't place the educator? And you see we run into complications in terms of unions and so forth. But it can be done, it has to be done. Other provinces have done it. And the longer you leave it like the Eastern Cape has, the more difficult it becomes. So you could have a situation where we're sitting with a shortage of educators, but still offering severance packages to their teachers because simply they're not of the right skill. Now, people would simply say, then why don't you reskill them? Now, anybody who's been involved in education for a while knows there are limits to how easily you can reskill. You can't take a foundation-based educator whose performance has been marginal and then reskill them in a short space of time to go and teach grade 10 history, for example. It doesn't work that easily. So these are some of the problems that we have. And clearly, we take very seriously what the president has said, and we're working on that issue. Now, as far as the department is concerned, there again, when the department was split, Department of Education was split into two departments, we had to resubmit an organogram, which we did, which was approved, but we didn't get a budget for it, which meant that we sat with a whole lot of vacancies which were unfunded. We then had to develop a new organogram to be consistent with the budget we got. Now, that has created a lag in terms of filling posts. The new organogram is about to be finalized now. We've got budgets now. The next financial year, which we will match to posts, and then fill those posts immediately. The posts that can be filled now, we are filling ASAP in terms of the operational needs, but also in terms of the injunction from the president to fill those posts. So that's what we're doing in that regard. But still on the question of posts, Honorable Makubela raised a very insightful point, which coincidentally was a matter we discussed as HEDCOM as well, which is that in South Africa, we've got a very low attrition rate, which means the proportion of teachers who leave the system every year is quite low. It's around 3%, 4%. The international benchmark is about 5 to 7%, which is considered normal. So our attrition is fairly good. However, the problem is the point the honorable member is raising. The average age of our teachers is quite high. And so there's a balloon around that age, which means that in a short space of time, in about 15 to 20 years, you could suddenly have the attrition rate shooting up.
Now, in any system, you've got to plan for that. In any system, you've got to say, if your attrition is about 3 or 4%, you rather push it up to 5% by allowing some older teachers to leave and then bringing in younger teachers. So even though you don't actually have that demand, you must create it so that you can gradually bring them in. That's the job of planners. That's my job and Patty's job before I became DG, is to say, how do you make sure that you create over time that kind of proportion in your system so it's not skewed heavily? Now, that requires very careful manipulation. We discussed it at ADCOM, and we're doing that now in terms of this program, Program 3, to say how do we deal with that matter to ensure that it's dealt with properly. So we celebrate the fact that our attrition is low, despite what anecdotally people assume and despite what we thought 10 years ago would be the impact of HIV/AIDS on the profession itself. It hasn't come to pass where mortality has been high. We do have a problem of morbidity, of absenteeism, but as far as mortality is concerned, contributing to attrition, it's not been a huge problem. So that's an area which the honorable members raised, which is a very important area. Now, SGB post and learner-educator ratios and so forth, Ms. Chebeka's answered the question about why we link it to classrooms. And that's very important, because otherwise it's a big inefficiency to have educators sitting in a school and they don't have a classroom to teach, so you're actually not using your full allocation. In addition to that, we've got to look at, as a country as a whole, what type of learner-educator ratio is optimal. Now, to speak to the point raised by Honorable Smiles, we do, in the existing and changed post-provisioning norms, cater for phases by catering for grades and curriculum. So as the curriculum changes from phase to phase, we build that into the model, its assumptions and its weightings, and we revise that from time to time. In addition, we have in the past already built into the model a more generous allocation based on the poverty level of the school. That is to offset the advantage that wealthy schools have to appoint SGB teachers. So what we do, if a school is poor, they get a more generous weighting compared to if a school is non-poor. And that try and caters for that. However, the big point is that because of high income quality in the country, as a government, it's not going to be possible to match what a rich former Model C school can do in poor schools. If we do that, our budget is already standing at about 120 billion rand, which was one of the questions Honorable James asked about what's it standing at. It's about 120 billion rand that we spend on educators. We spend around 80 in some provinces upward on teacher salaries alone. We spend 20% of our budget on education. We spend 6% of GDP on education. We are in the upper limits of what the country can afford. If we increase those aggregate figures, the country could end up having a huge problem because, A, we're spending as a government more than we're getting in, so we're in deficit. If we increase that, we're increasing the deficit. If you change learner-educator ratios, you're immediately pushing up the salary bar. That's the immediate thing you're doing. So we've got to assess that very, very carefully. And as a system, we constantly break our heads to say, where does the efficiencies lie? Where can we actually improve what we do? And the bottom line, honorable members, if you look for efficiency, the bottom line is to improve the quality of education. Because currently, if you have high failure and retention rate, you artificially increase learner numbers. Learner numbers drive how many educators you need. Because the learner numbers are high. For the same amount of money, you have a higher ratio compared to if your system is efficient in terms of pass rate. So everything comes back to quality. It comes back to not just how many educators, not just what the learner-educator ratio is, but how well those educators can teach. So we're sitting with this catch-22. We've got a tight learner-educator ratio. At the same time, we want to improve quality. That is the challenge that we're trying to address. If you look at across programs, you'll see quality, quality, quality. Annual national assessment is about that. Accountability is about that. This program, 3, is about improving the quality of educators in the system to address it. So this thing about learner-educator ratios is a big, big issue that we've got to address all the time. What research does show, Honorable Smiles, is that whether or not a low educator ratio makes a difference, or to be more accurate, a small class size makes a difference. It varies from country to country and context to context. What it does show also is that below a certain number and above a certain number, it makes very little difference. And that's what research shows over and over again. It's other interventions that you've got to demonstrate in order to improve it. So, Honorable Chairperson, this is a very big area which maybe, you know, the committee could discuss at some point. And we'll be very available to come and present some of the research that was done, some of the thinking, some of the challenges from a planning perspective and from a teacher development perspective on how we can deal with these matters. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, DG. I think you are correct because I want to put it down. Because we still have a report on quality and access to education,
yes,
that we have to discuss.
Yes.
And I think it will be very important to have that discussion with the report, because the report is looking at quite a number of scenarios.
Yeah.
And then what will be important is for you to come with the hard figures.
Yes.
You know, just give us the hard figures. Because when a person speaks quality, you have to look at that school, the ratios, etc. Thank you. Let us look at program one.
Just on the provinces with regard to continuing professional teacher development, district development and governance, those three functions which is located in this program. Are you happy with the plans that provinces has given you? And is there any risks that you know that you are anticipating, and what are you doing about it? Thank you.
Let's speak to it briefly, because we are going to have a report. We would like to speak to provinces. Thank you. That's it briefly. Smiles, are you upset? All right.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Ms. Chebeka will respond to that. I know.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. We are working with provinces, and we've got plans and we've got targets for them. I would not say we're satisfied. It's work in progress. But our sector plan, as we said yesterday, gives us an anchor point which we haven't always had in the system, and therefore again, as the chairperson suggests, it's one area that we could come, because what is important is to present the actual plans that we're speaking to, but there are plans for all of the provinces in the areas that you're talking about. Thank you.
Satisfied? Thank you. And I think these plans that you have, make it available to us to, you know, just before you come to speak to us about it. Let us look at program one. Any questions on program one? Because they will speak to the ministry, department management, corporate services, office of the chief financial officer, internal audit, and office accommodation. Any questions there? Just out loud.
On office accommodation, and I will not put a question, but rather to ask, can you sort of explain the table right at the back where this office accommodation is sort of being explained? It's on page, in this document, to ask again the estimates, this one.
Yes. Speak to the internal audit too, please. Whether it is in place, etc. Although I know these questions we're going to ask under the annual report. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Smiles. on page 31, simply gives a breakdown of the cost of the building, and you'll see it's high compared to what our costs were, accommodation costs were before we moved into these new premises. It's because it's a PPP. And in terms of the PPP, we're paying off the capital costs as well as the facilities management costs, etc. And therefore, it amounts to about 10 million rand a month, which is why you see the total there, around 120 million. The advisory fees, 500,000, and project monitoring costs, which is important for us to ensure that we monitor the PPP quite carefully. So that's the cost that's there, and this is something transacted by Treasury, and it's a model used for all departments that are having PPPs to build accommodation. So after a certain period of time, government will own this building and then can continue with facilities management, but the capital would have been paid off for the building itself. And according to Treasury's projections, this is an efficient modality for procurement. We didn't do any of that. It was done by Treasury, Public Works was involved, etc. And this process started, if I recall well, in fact, even before 98. It started around about 96 or 97 to get the building started. So I never answered the Honourable Member's question. Honourable Chairperson, then, in terms of your question, internal audit, we are not happy with the capacity of internal audit. With the split of the department into two, the internal audit was split. And I don't know if we ended up with the weak capacity or what, but I don't know what HET has got, but we certainly don't have the capacity required. Our audit committee have raised with us this concern, and I have now asked the acting CFO to put steps into place, which she has done, to, in the meantime, get an external auditing company to do this, because this is very important. We can't let this fall between the cracks. So we've got a risk assessment, which we're finalizing. We've got a risk mitigation strategy. We've got an internal audit coverage plan that needs to be implemented and completed for the current financial year. We're getting in an external company to complete that for us. In addition, for the next financial year, we're getting external capacity, which other departments are doing, to run internal audit, whilst at the same time, we're recruiting for a director internal audit. Now, because this was introduced by the PFMA and suddenly increased the demand for internal audit in the country, like when we introduced the requirement for a CFO, it increased the demand for chartered accountants. We interviewed for a director internal audit the other day, about a week or 2 weeks ago, and none of the candidates came even close to being appropriate. So we're sitting with that kind of problem. But what we will do is continue that process, but ensure in the meantime that we do bring in capacity to run internal audit for us. But it is a concern we share with you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think let us look at Program 2, Curriculum, Policy Support and Monitoring. Honourable
I believe that I'll be relevant on Program 1. The previous year, we had an interest in understanding the department's affiliation or subscriptions to international bodies, and actually whether the such collaborations do derive any beneficiation to the country, or we just happy that we're subscribing to all these perhaps progressive bodies, but in terms of what we get back from those, we may not clearly indicate or account for the money. So this time around, perhaps we may need to be informed as well whether or spin-offs resulting from these affiliations. Thanks.
I think we spoke to it yesterday. Just speak to it again. Thank you.
Ms. Carlson will answer, I'll add after that, with your permission.
Must be hearing her voice.
Thanks, Honourable Chair and members. In relation to the questions of our international commitments, we have three levels at which we operate through those international commitments. The agenda is largely set by our foreign policy objectives of government, which is guided by what DERCO prescribed as our list of priorities. However, as a sectoral representative, the education department is the lead department of the multilateral agencies related to UNESCO and others related to our global partnerships, which will contribute to our policies and our programs supported by the EU and other agencies. But what we also have responsibility to is to take leadership in and around UNESCO activities in terms of research and other opportunities that present itself there. In terms of the agreements around our other international relations obligations, those agreements have largely been cast under a new light in terms of the split as well. Most of the former agreements of the Department of Education related to higher education partnerships with member countries. And in this instance, we are currently sort of initiating our own basic education partnership agreements, which also, in terms of the government's broader priorities, would receive attention in that particular order. The work that we do around the work of separate units within the department, our programs there, are informed by the funding agreements, and those funding agreements are, as I said, have also largely been inherited either from what we had at COE or what we will now renegotiate afresh as the Department of Basic Education, where basic education priorities are affected. In terms of our other work that we do around educational diplomacy, the visits that we get with our from other education ministries to our minister and the department, we continue to host those. The work that we do in Africa continues, but we also have to prioritize in terms of our action plan how these will impact on the general operations of the Department of Basic Education, and we tend to prioritize according to that.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The question was whether we derive benefits from those things. So let me answer that question directly. We have been concerned, given the plethora of agreements we have and the subscriptions we pay, about the benefits. Frankly, our concern has been it's not evident, self-evident, that there are those benefits. We've done a lot of travel. Every time UNESCO has an event, they invite the department, and officials have almost felt a compulsion to go on to any event that UNESCO asks. The recent article in the paper about the size of the South African delegation is a phenomenon where, frankly, you know, any UN initiative, UNESCO initiative in our case, South Africa's got the biggest delegation. We can demonstrate, and I've asked for this, clear benefits in terms of evidence of this. It's simply we've got the agreement, so we go. With that, we've asked for a few things to happen. One is that we host the UNESCO Secretariat, UNESCO Commission Secretariat, and we've asked them not to assume the renewal of that commitment, that we want a review of the efficacy of the Commission in terms of South Africa and what it's contributed. So they're doing that, both themselves and we commission an external review. I've also asked for a review of all our commitments, including our travels. I must confess that having been in government for a long time, I think government officials completely misunderstand the purpose of a trip or a study tour. Very often we go on an expensive study tour, take time away from the office to learn things which, frankly, you can learn in half an hour using the internet, and probably better. So there's this complete distortion of what international travel has been. I should say to honourable members, I know I've been unpopular in my previous capacity as DG of SEMD and now, because I don't assume that travel is an automatic thing overseas. So in terms of the spirit of the honourable member's question, where I understand you to be coming from, I want to confirm to you that we share that concern with you, and we are reviewing very carefully the motivation for travel, the motivation for commitments, the motivation in participation in study tours, in conferences, etc., on the basis that it must demonstrate value for South Africa and what we're doing here. It's not clear that value is demonstrated. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Thanks for that. I think what the committee is going to need is we just want your commitments, international agreements. You can just put it like one liner. And then what is the status of each one at the moment? Because I think we need it with empowerment. We were asked the question already, that they want to know what international agreements do education have. And then you can speak shortly at the bottom to the review of all these commitments. Thank you. And thanks a lot for that question. It was a very interesting answer. Let's look at program two, because we're coming fewer and fewer.
There were people or
human resources were there, but there were no classrooms and there were no workshops and there were no equipment. And then there was a lot of money invested, but that project was not monitored properly, with the result FET Colleges is not what it is as expected after that kind of injection, billions, I would imagine. So what is the risk management here, you know, being that it will be in the provinces once again? Thank you.
It will just be two things, Chair. Let me start with the one on curriculum support and so on. At the district level, how is that support being given currently? Are you satisfied that schools are being assisted in the manner in which your districts are structured, like the old types have been in the past, or you've got a new approach to all that, ensuring that that is enhanced? And whether, I think I'm just bringing in this one, Chair, whether you are in favor as management for the what's the correct word, for the colleges, teacher colleges to be reopened, or you feel the new approach that it will be handled elsewhere is fine. The second issue regarding tariff good. There was an issue of those to facilitate or teach those people that they were not being paid timely, or in some instances they were not even paid at all. What is the status now? Have we rectified that problem or is still persisting? Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. And then I think the department is making progress on curriculum and assessment policy treatment. And recognizing that the curriculum issue are very critical to teaching and learning, I just want to inquire if there is adequate system preparation and whether CAPS will be able to address curriculum gaps. Thank you, Chairperson.
My answer, DG.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I'm going to ask Mr. Masue, I almost said Honorable Masue, Mr. Masue, to answer the curriculum-related questions. And then Ms. Chebeka will come in on the question around districts and the one on teacher colleges. And then I'll come in after that with your permission, Honorable Chairperson.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm actually going, the Honorable Chairperson, if you agree, in terms of the EPWP program, to request that we defer that matter to Ms. Carras, because she did a lot with that program from the department. But if it relates to the curriculum model, and let me indicate here, in terms of the information that we have, is that having noted the extent to which the program has been implemented, we have gone to extent of wanting to explore mechanisms by which we could actually, as a matter of fact, also offer ECD programs alongside the curriculum model, given the lessons that are coming from that particular model. So the question was asked about the track record in terms of what the program has done, and there is evidence that it will show that some of the, I would call them letters of students that come to the curriculum centers, as an example, also bring young people in. And the question was, how then do you begin to support those children that they come with? And that's why we wanted to explore a model of OECD, I do not think it might be an omission in terms of what is reflected on the vote, but in fact OECD is actually a central component of the department's strategic plan as well as an action plan to 2014. One of the key areas that this particular program seeks to do is just to make sure that we actually have a concretized policy that also begins to guide on in terms of how we can entrench ECD programs in more specific terms. I should indicate actually the matter that HEDCOM also began to request the department to fast track insofar as it relates to ensuring that we can regulate and normalize the system as it relates to ECD, so that by 2014 we could be able to achieve the enrollment targets and the quality targets that we have set ourselves in this particular regard. Honorable Chairperson, there's a question in relation to the Dinaledi schools, and it is indicated that there's a debate. I think maybe what may need to be explained here is that the Dinaledi schools, although they are math and science, it's a project that government had started with respect to mathematics and science. It is not the only, the Dinaledi schools are not the only schools that have to contribute to the improvement in mathematics and science, and I think it's an important matter. You may, honorable members may be aware that since the inception of the program, there has never been any national allocation of funds, or rather an allocation from the fiscal that would say it was directly targeted to Dinaledi schools. So the 70 million that is being spoken to by Honorable Smiles is the first of an allocation that would have come for the Dinaledi schools project from the fiscal in a direct and targeted way. What we have sought to do in this particular regard, honorable members may also be aware that since 2008 up to 2010, we have had in conjunction and collaboration with the World Bank carried out an independent impact evaluation study on the Dinaledi schools program. And there are lessons that have come out of that program. One is that it was effective, but however, what becomes important is to understand factors that have actually caused the effectiveness of the program in those schools where it had been noted, with a view that such lessons can then be expanded to other areas. And we're planning that the injection of capital that has now come, that seeks to make sure that all of the schools can be given, that can be brought to the same level, would then be used in that particular regard. Safe to say, though, that this is not it's a national grant, but that is administered as a conditional grant, and therefore the funding is actually located with provinces rather than it would be in DBE. And the presentation on the National Schools Nutrition Program has also begun to demonstrate, which also links to the technical schools, that having noted the challenges with respect to the spending that often goes and the causal effect of the quality or the outcomes that one seeks to see as it relates to the funding that you put, the department the department is planning to put up a project management team that can ensure that all blockages that technical and otherwise that may be that may come along in terms of the administration of conditional grants can be unblocked to ensure that we can get the results that we're looking for, and that therefore speaks to the risk management plan that we're talking to in terms of technical schools and conditional grant, as was asked. There's a question that is spoken to in relation to the curriculum and assessment policy statement and the extent to which there is adequate system preparation. Honourable members may recall that one of the things that when the minister announced that the curriculum and assessment policy statements will be incrementally phased in, we will phase in foundation phase and grade 10 in 2012. We will then go to the senior phase, intermediate phase, and grade 11 in 2013, and ultimately to 2014 in grade 12. The whole idea was to ensure that on an incremental basis we would also provide for support. I can report, Honourable Chair, that at this point in time the Department of Basic Education has already developed, on the side of teacher preparation, a training toolkit, and Mrs. Jobeka referred to it yesterday in her presentation in one of the responses. And the whole idea of that training toolkit is to ensure that all teachers in the system would have access to that, and it would then bring them to understand the implementation of curriculum. We have already already at this point in time trained over 336 subject advisors for the foundation phase that come up from all provinces, and the whole idea is to make sure that those districts will then be able to further provide support and training of teachers in each of the respective provinces. But the implementation of CAPS would also require that we have appropriate textbooks and LTSM in the system, but equally ensure that all of the aspects of the system are prepared. Honorable Chair, we have been able to provide the curriculum and assessment policy statements to publishers, and we are they are currently working, and we are of the view that by August would by June there would be a submission process for the appropriate LTSM, and then we will be able to get the system to have appropriate LTSM in this particular regard. The other matter, as it relates to the curriculum and assessment policy statement, and it's a matter that was considered by HEDCOM yesterday, was the whole question, Chair, of ensuring that this time around, as we implement the curriculum in its repackaged and revised fashion, we must make sure that it gets implemented in all schools, in schools that may also be in different contexts. And as a result of that, we are proposing to move forward with ensuring that we actually, within the next month, get the a process of conducting a doability test, and that will ensure that we bring practitioners, and in this regard, it's bringing teachers on board, and as well as ensuring that we bring those that wrote the CAP, so that there could be a common understanding of it, and therefore seek to make sure that there is a common understanding, rather, in terms of the practicality and ability of the CAPs to be implemented, but also to ensure policy coherence in terms of how that may be implemented. The whole question of the support, the extent to which there has been support to the district level support of curriculum, this particular question, Chair, has it's a matter that's at the heart. In fact, the Action Plan to 2014 speaks to that. That unless we can get districts to support schools effectively, many of the interventions that we do would not necessarily be adequate. And it is in that context that the district, as a locus of school support and school functionality, is fundamental. As it relates to the extent to which there has been support of the districts to schools, this has been variable in different provinces. And I think the whole question is how we get a district model that can ensure that this level of support would finally be achieved across the system. Chair, I think that is all I can report to through UDG, if I were to take back to whatever.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr.
Chebeka.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Maybe to pick up on the last question that Mr. Msuwe was responding to, the Honorable Makwele said our schools being supported or is district capacity where it was before. Firstly, is to confirm what Mr. Msuwe says, that it is variable across the provinces. There are provinces where, and districts within provinces, where schools are being supported, but it is not optimal. What we have in the system currently are guidelines that were adopted by CEM that provide, firstly, the key areas around which we would expect districts to support schools, but secondly, raise accountability levels in the system, starting with the districts, to ensure that all of the people there, I mean, that especially they have support plans for the schools. They've got district development plans that show that they understand where their schools are at and have a strategy to support them to meet the outcomes that are indicated. And thirdly, to provide the information at all levels, at all times that is necessary for schools. That's the first part. You ask about district capacity. District capacity in terms of warm bodies is again varied in the way that you understand it. But we have not put that at the center of our strategy to ensure support to schools. What we're looking at are the outcomes that we've all agreed to and the plans of provinces to assist schools to actually meet those outcomes. Because in a number of instances we have had, as you would know, district officials who actually are not capable of providing the support that we need and taking the schools where we need them to go. And therefore, in providing very clear guidelines of what the expectations are and interrogating their own plans to provide that support, we're able to engage and assist before we even fill the vacant posts that are there. The posts that we're prioritizing are your management posts, your district posts, as well as your second management posts, firstly, so that there is strategic leadership that can do. One of the things that we believe has to happen is to harness the capacity that's provided by the NGOs, and we've just completed an audit, starting with just the Eastern Cape, to look at the NGOs that are operating in those districts. And we think that there is sufficient capacity, first of all, within those NGOs to get us moving. So that's where we are, but a short answer is that we are not happy that all districts are providing the support that is needed. That's a major focus for 2011, and we're hoping that we will improve what is happening on the ground currently. The second question was around colleges and what our position is. Maybe the first is to state up front that is not our primary function. That is the DHET, Department of Higher Education, that has a responsibility for that. However, we've been engaging with the Department of Higher Education because there are areas that, in our view, would benefit from colleges being open, like, for instance, your training of your early childhood development practitioners, and training them into teaching. We don't think that sits very comfortably within higher education institutions, but that's a debate we have in, but the final responsibility will lie with the Department of Higher Education. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Very quickly then, in terms of the question by Honourable Member Mashishi about the EPWP, in terms of the DBE, Kariguda is the only program where we have EPWP because we don't really have a lot of activity that lends itself to that in our department. But in the system, another big take-up area is ECD. So if you look at especially pre-grade R ECD, is where EPWP kicks in a lot. And there we work very closely with the Department of Social Development to develop an integrated ECD strategy. Upcoming, we're exploring further areas. Clearly, in the case of our infrastructure rollout at a provincial level, we're looking there at how EPWP job creation can fit into that. In fact, not accessing necessarily EPWP, but the job creation priority is built in very explicitly into our infrastructure rollout plan. Where labor-intensive modalities can be employed, we're employing it. Where we can mobilize local communities to include training into the project and job creation, we're doing that. Another area we're exploring, and that's very tentative at this point in time, is to look at the notion of an e-cader who can actually work with schools to support e-learning in the schools. Because we find that teachers struggle. We've got a laptop initiative, but to actually get to use it, some teachers struggle. And we think we can employ some of these youngsters, link them to a CETA, train them, use EPWP and CETA money. That can be a good model. So with Mr. Masuwe and them, we're exploring that one. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
I think we are completed with the department. Fine, Honorable Makubela.
Chair, this one will not be like a major question, but the department should be made aware, although the attitude of the person I engaged was offline, but I feel it's better to raise it here as well. Early January, when schools were opening, we took rounds in some area. Now there's a layer school. It was about something else, but then I got across this attitude. The principal in that large school was complaining about having a lot of pressure from neighboring areas, villages, townships, African areas, into town because that school is performing well together with others in that town. And he was talking for his own school, to saying we've got a lot of pressure, we can't take any more kids into this school. And then he was questioning me, why were we not able to create other schools of excellence where these kids are coming from, so that we take away the pressure from his school. Well, we engaged a little bit. I think you understand where I'm coming from. So all he's saying is that since 1994, according to him, we have not been able to create other schools of excellence like that Lyle school, hence the pressure. Even if the principals in those schools, together with him, do sit the public school, isn't it? Do sit in the same meetings and so on, and according to him, they've got the understanding of how to run the school. And in terms of that curriculum delivered, there's differences in terms of outcomes. I know there won't be an easy answer to it. There will be a lot more other things to decide and so on and so on. And I don't want us to go to the other aspect. But I'm saying there's a challenge down there wherein attitudes now are building up. And unless we are able to ensure that in the same district and so on, at least we can perform regardless of whether this school is in town or wherever, unless we can perform better, we'll have this situation or scenario going on and on for a long time, which will be a problem at some point. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Chairperson, I think as Honourable Member Makabela has indicated, it is a big question, not necessarily for engagement here. I think the point you raise about the discussion on quality and excess, I think this matter fits squarely under there, because this is an example which is more a phenomenon which finds expression elsewhere in the country of how learners migrate from township areas into former Model C schools. It's a key question around the banner of quality education and access to it, because learners are migrating across a quality gradient there. So with your permission, Honourable Member's permission, if we have that substantive discussion under that heading, we won't do justice to it now with a quick response.
That will be the last Honourable Smiles.
Maybe two technical omissions or corrections that need to be made. On page 6 in this document, the first paragraph on Karikure, it reads that this project is aimed at reducing adult literacy. Is that correct? Okay. Yes. Now there stands literacy. Now imagine if the public reads this thing. Then they will say, take the money away from Karikure, give it to somebody else. So if there's a correction that needs to be made there. Then on page 5, under economic classification, the medium-term expenditure, the third row from, column from the right, right at payments and capital assets. That figure don't tell you, because there's a 700 million that's not indicated there. You see that one in bold, 705 million, and then just below that you get 5 million and then 87 million. So there's a 700 that's not there. Am I correct?
Yes, just look on page 5, okay?
On page 5.
Wait, just give us the line, what line?
It's a...
On the current payment.
Yeah. Under...
Compensation.
Right at the bottom, where it stands, payments for capital assets. Right? Under this year, yeah. So it doesn't tell you. If you add up, there's a of 700 million.
Rectified, Honorable Chairperson, and maybe the department should get into Kariguri for literacy. Honorable Chairperson, back for Council, but we are asked to edit it, so we take responsibility. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for those technical points. The department now, what you have to give us. But then what I'd like to add on is we have to still discuss the Millennium Development Goals. And we're going to do that discussion before June, because there will be a seminar or a conference later in the year. You spoke to the ECD, because I was interested in the social development side of ECD, but you spoke to that. And I think we need to have this, the integrated plan when it comes to sport. We do have a program for the, for our meeting till June. It's still being approved within Parliament. Then we'll send it to the department, and you'll notice little things like sports will be there, CAPS will be there, the Millennium Development Goals will be there, the date that we'll discuss it. And then I think we have to still fit in quality education that exists. To quality education. We don't have it on our program. I want to thank the department. I think it was very informative having you here for 2 days. I don't think we picked up any major problems. No, there were no major problems at all. The only major problem I know is that one of the opposition parties is not going to support the budget, the education budget vote 15. But I told them to put it into writing that we know exactly what should be improved, because it's no use saying you don't approve, and we don't know what is the disapproval about. So thanks, department. Tomorrow we're having SAIS and ERC, and it will be very important for senior officials to be in that meeting. We want no one junior, only senior, like we had with Uma Lucy. And then on the 13th, vote 15 will be debated here in Parliament. We're not sure where. And I think we have 170 minutes allocated towards that debate, only from the parliamentary side. And on the 12th, we don't need you, but we need the committee. The morning of the 12th, we'll have to accept vote 15 as a whole. Yes, and in the committee report, and tomorrow afternoon, we're accepting, we're going to approve the minutes, and we're approving, I think that report on quality education, because we don't have a quorum. And I'd like to thank the department for being with us, and taking time off from your work for the last 2 days, but I'm sure you did it remote control.